remembering. I left off Strangers on a Train, however. Marty, who was always looking for book recommendations, wrote some of the titles down in his little notebook. The ABC Murders, he said. I like the sound of that. These days, I think I like reading Agatha Christie more than I like reading James Ellroy. Don't know what it is, but maybe I'm getting soft.
You've been reading Agatha Christie?
Yeah, like you told me to, remember? I just read 10 Little Indians.
And then there were none, I said, almost automatically. It was the less offensive title that the book was now sold under.
Right, that one. Now that was a perfect crime. Too bad more murderers don't copy that book.
Kill yourself after you commit the murders, you mean? I said.
I didn't remember telling him to read Agatha Christie, but I'm sure I did.
It sounded like me.
We ordered another beer and talked about books and a little about his family. He asked if I wanted to stay for a third beer, but I decided to bow out. As always with Marty, I liked spending time with him, but after a while we'd run out of things to say and I would feel sad and lonely. I've always felt that being with people as opposed to being alone can make you feel loneliness more acutely.
You gonna do anything about Nick Pruitt? He asked as I was pulling on my jacket.
No, I said. Not unless the FBI decides to talk with me again. If they do, then I guess I could mention him, say that I had an ex-cop look into the Norman Chaney murder and how Pruitt looked like a suspect.
I wouldn't mention my name, Marty said. If you don't mind.
No, of course not. In fact, I won't mention it at all. I think I was just curious, was all. I was baffled that they'd made some connection between me and these crimes.
I figured you were going to tell me it had to do with Nero, Marty said, then finished off his beer.
Huh? I said.
Oh, I figured that the FBI came calling on you with questions about Norman Chaney because of your cat, Nero, in the store.
Why? I said, trying to sound relatively calm.
Well, I was reading the police reports, and Norman Chaney had a cat, a ginger one, like Nero, that went missing after the homicide. I read that, then I thought that might be the connection.
That's funny, I said.
He's a little bit of a celebrity, that Nero, you know.
I know he is. Half the people who come to our store come to see him. Emily tells me he has his own Instagram page, although I've never seen it. No, they didn't ask me anything about my cat, and he doesn't come from Vermont anyway.
I laughed, and it sounded fake in my own head.
I might stay here for one more, Marty said.
I thanked him again and went out into the night. The temperature had dropped in the time I'd spent with Marty, and I walked home carefully, avoiding patches of black ice on the narrow sidewalks. When I reached my street, I didn't immediately see her, waiting in the shadow of the dead linden tree in front of my house, but I did sense her. It was the feeling I'd been experiencing lately, that feeling that I was being watched. At my stairwell, she stepped out of the shadows and said,
"Hi, Mal."
Chapter 20.
Hi, Gwen, I said.
You don't seem surprised to see me.
I guess not. I spoke with two other FBI agents today, and they told me that you'd been suspended.
Who did you talk to?
She said, stepping forward so that she was now in the light from the street. Her breath was billowing in the cold night, but I wasn't sure I wanted to invite her in.
One agent from New Haven.
Barry, right?
Look, I said, I'm just not sure I should really be talking to you.
No, I totally understand. I don't want anything from you, but I was hoping to at least talk, just for a little while, explain what happened. I would have called you, but I couldn't do that. Can I come up, or could we grab a drink somewhere? Anywhere but where we're standing right now?
We walked down my street to Charles and got a booth at the Sevens, where we each ordered a Newcastle brown ale. Gwen removed her coat but kept a thick woolen scarf wrapped around her neck. Her cheeks and the tip of her nose were still red from being outside.
What do you want to know?
She said. You've been suspended?
Yes, pending a review.
How come? She took a sip from her bottle of beer, then licked foam from her upper lip.
When I presented what I'd learned to my supervisors, well, not what I'd learned so much, but what I suspected, that there was a connection between several unsolved crimes in the New England area, I was told not to pursue the case. I made the mistake of telling them what had initially led me to you. The thing is, I knew who you were already. I'd heard your name, anyway, because once upon a time, I knew your wife. I knew Claire.
Her eyes were looking at me, but not looking at me, landing somewhere around my chin. How did you know Claire? I said.
I knew her because my father was one of her teachers in middle school. Steve Clifton.
I needed to make a decision. I needed to decide whether I was going to play dumb or if I was going to tell her the truth. Most of it, anyway. I think the look on her face was what made me decide that I needed to be truthful. She looked terrified, and I realized that if she'd made a decision to be honest with me, I should return the favor. Yes, I know all about him.
What do you know?
I know that he molested Claire over the course of 2 years while she was in middle school. He screwed up her life.
She told you about it?
Yes.
What did she say about it? If you don't mind my asking. I understand if you feel...
She broke off, and I realized how hard this was for her. I said, to tell the truth, we didn't talk much about the details. She brought it up early on in our relationship, said it was important for me to know, but she always downplayed it, at least to me. Gwen was nodding.
You don't have to tell me exactly what she told you. I understand.
Why don't you have his last name? I said. Why aren't you Gwen Clifton?
I was, of course, for years, but I had my name legally changed. Mulvey is my mother's maiden name.
That makes sense, I said. Then I added, did you actually know Claire?
Yes, I remember her. I was younger than she was by about 5 years, but she used to come to the house. Several of my father's students used to come to the house, and I remember her because she played Boggle with me a bunch of times. And then later, when I was in high school, my father confessed to me what he'd done, and hers was one of the names he told me.
He told you what he'd done? Gwen pursed her lips and breathed out.
At this point, Claire had already graduated, but another student or two students, maybe, had come forward and accused him of inappropriate touching.
Everyone knew. We lived in the same town that he taught in. It was one of those already awkward situations where he was a teacher at the same middle school I attended, although he was never my teacher. He resigned. He was forced to resign, and there must have been some kind of legal settlement because it never went to court. Or else there wasn't enough evidence. One night, he came to my room. She stopped speaking and pressed her index finger against her left eye for a moment. You don't have to tell me all this, I said.
He came to my room and told me the names of the girls he'd molested, including Claire's name, and he said he did it to protect me, that he never wanted to do anything to me, so he did it to other girls.
She shrugged and pressed her lips together into something that looked like a half smile.
Jesus, I said. Yeah, she said. So I never forgot Claire's name. And I remembered later hearing how she died and looking up her obituary and finding your name. So I knew about you as well.
What about you and your dad?
That time he came and talked to me was the last time we ever talked. He left the house after that and my parents divorced, and I never saw him again. He was killed, you know.
He was murdered?
Not officially, no, but yes, I believe he was.
How?
Don't you know?
She said. I was drinking from my bottle of beer even though it was empty. You think I killed him? I said. She shrugged again and gave me that odd smile.
The color had disappeared from her cheeks and from her nose, and as usual, I found it hard to read her face, the paleness of it, the flatness of her eyes. "I don't really know, Mal, but at this point I don't know what to believe. Do you really want to hear what I think?"
"I do."
"Okay. Eric Atwell was murdered, and I know that you weren't in the state, but that doesn't mean you couldn't have arranged it. My father was run down by a car when he was on his bicycle. It was a hit and run, but I always assumed someone had killed him for what he'd done. It would make sense. Both of those killings would make sense, would be justified, really, especially for the husband of Claire Mallory."
"I will admit that I don't feel bad for either of them," I said, and tried on my own smile that I'm sure looked as awkward as hers.
"But that's all you'll admit?"
"What does either Eric Atwell or your father have to do with my list and the other murders?"
"I don't know. Maybe nothing. After my father was killed, I did think about you again. I'd also heard about Eric Atwell's death, and I figured you might have something to do with that as well. I didn't care, even though I was training at the time to be an FBI agent. I knew someone had killed my father, and I actually hoped that it was someone with a reason for doing it, not someone who just accidentally ran him over and then took off. I wanted his death to be revenge, and I assumed that it was. Honestly, it's something that helps me sleep at night. And in my mind, I thought that it was probably you. There were other girls my father victimized, but Claire is the one I always remember, probably because she was kind to me, and I'll never forget that. And while I was learning about you, I discovered the list. I've had it memorized, I think, for many years, and I thought of it right away. I thought of the ABC murders, after hearing about the feathers that were sent to the police station.
"You thought I committed all those murders?"
She shifted forward on her wooden seat. No, I didn't. I don't know what I thought, really, except that something was going on. Something that might have to do with my father and with you. I got obsessed with it, even thought that maybe my father's death was related to the secret history.
"How?" I said.
"Because, in a way, he picked the circumstances of his death."
"Because he biked a lot?"
"Uh-huh. He biked all the time, especially after the divorce, after he'd moved to upstate New York. Not that I knew this from personal experience, but I read the police report on his death. He always biked alone, hills mainly, on quiet roads. He was hit by a car going the other way. So yeah. I did think about secret history. If someone wanted to kill him, then running him down while he biked would be the easiest thing to do. It would look like an accident. Well, an accident that someone fled from, but it wouldn't necessarily look like a homicide."
"You told your boss all this?"
"Not at first. When I first brought it to him, I told him about your list and how it connected with the Byrd murders and with Bill Manso in Connecticut and how I wanted to follow it up, but he didn't bite. I made the mistake of mentioning that there was also a connection to my father's death, and that was when I was told that I was barred from investigating any further, that it would be handed off to other agents if they saw fit. I was on vacation last week when I questioned you and when we went up to Rockland. Someone at the coroner's office got in touch with my office instead of me directly, and that's how I got busted. And that's why I'm suspended. If they knew I was here now, I'd be fired for sure."
"So why are you here?"
"I think," she said, then paused. "I think I felt I owed you the truth, and maybe I'm warning you as well. They know everything I know. You are a suspect."
"You must think I'm a suspect as well."
"I don't know what to think anymore. Do I think you killed Elaine Johnson up in Maine, or Bill Manso, or Robin Callahan, or Ethan Byrd? I don't really think so, but that's just a feeling. I know you're not telling me the whole truth. If I had to come up with a theory, and I know it'll sound ridiculous, but I think that maybe you talked someone into doing something to Eric Atwell, and maybe even my father. And now, this person, whoever they are.
Charlie, remember? I said.
Right. Charlie. Look, I haven't slept in days. I wanted to talk with you, and we've talked. I can't have anything more to do with this investigation, not if I want to keep my job. Can I ask you to keep this meeting secret?
Of course. She took a sip of her beer, still three quarters full.
And if you did have anything to do with the death of my father?
I didn't.
But if you did, know that there is no one alive who mourned his death.
She stood up suddenly, banging her thighs against the table between us. You okay? I said.
I'm fine. I'm just exhausted.
What are you going to do now?
I'm going to drive home, and I'm going to try and forget about all this.
I walked her to her car, wondering if I should offer her my couch for the night, but decided that was a bad idea for multiple reasons, besides which I don't think she would have accepted. And I wasn't sure I wanted her there myself. She had not been honest with me, and I wasn't convinced she was being entirely honest now. At her Equinox, parked near the flat of the Hill Hotel, we stood for a moment in the whistling wind. Gwen had begun to shiver.
Are you still rereading the books? She said.
I've been reading The Secret History, I said.
Suddenly that title takes on a whole new significance.
I laughed.
It does, I suppose. Any new insights?
From the books?
From anything?
Can I tell you something that you won't share unless you have to?
I'm not even supposed to be here talking with you, so yeah, I wouldn't worry about it.
Okay, I said. It's just a name that came up. I won't say how, but if anything does happen to me, maybe take a look at someone named Nicholas Pruitt. She repeated the name back to me, and I spelled it for her.
Who is he?
He's an English professor. It's probably nothing, but...
Okay,
she said.
Hopefully he'll be fine, and I won't have to look into his name.
We said goodbye, neither of us offering a handshake or a hug. Then I walked back to my apartment, thinking about everything we'd just said to each other. I'd been home for 20 minutes, wide awake, when I considered leaving again, driving to New Essex and confronting Nick Pruitt that night. I had gotten his address online from searching the online version of the White Pages, then found his house on Zillow, a place that posted real estate transactions. He lived in a single-family home on the outskirts of New Essex, in a neighborhood near the university. I could just show up at his door and knock on it. If Nick was Charlie, and I felt almost positive that he was, then he'd know me on sight. Maybe I could just talk with him, find out what he wanted, ask him to stop. But if I went to his house that night, who knew how he would act? Who knew if he'd even be alone? I decided to drive to New Essex early the next morning, stake out his house, watch him for a while. It might give me an advantage.
Chapter 21. Early the next morning, before driving to New Essex, I went to Old Devil's. Nero came up through his cat door from the basement to greet me, walking with purpose, his head up. I picked him up and cradled him in my arms, scratching under his chin. I'd asked myself before whether it had been worth it to save him, and I believe it had. I don't know if there really is a way to rate an animal's happiness, but I believe he loves his life in the bookstore. I put him down, picking one of his hairs off my wool coat. Would they have collected his hairs from Norman Chaney's house in Tickhill during the investigation of his murder? Would they have considered them important or irrelevant? I didn't really know. I left a note with a list of things to do for Emily and Brandon, then went back out into the cold morning. I was in New Essex a little over an hour later, idling along the curb across from where Nick Pruitt lived, a small square house with a mansard roof. It was 8 in the morning, and I felt conspicuous. Corning Street was almost entirely residential, and all the houses had driveways. Mine was the only car parked along the curb. There was a corner store back about 100 yards. I U-turned and parked in front of it, turned off my engine. I still had a view of Pruitt's house, and if anyone questioned why I was sitting in my car, I could say I was about to go into the store. The car began to steam up, and I cleared a small patch on the bottom right of the windshield so that I could still watch the house while slumped in my seat. I took small sips from my thermos of coffee. There was a car parked in his driveway, something sporty that might be a Porsche, but that didn't necessarily mean that he was still home. He worked at the university, only a few blocks away. If he was teaching a morning class, he could easily walk there. While waiting, I went over my list of books in my mind, connecting them with the murders. Unless Gwen Mulvey hadn't spotted one of them, then Charlie had committed murders described in 4 of the 8 books on my list, possibly 5. The first one, of course, was done with me, Eric Atwell and Norman Chaney, the swapped murders from Strangers on a Train. Then Charlie had recreated the plot from the ABC murders, substituting people with birds in their names. Bill Manso had been killed using the idea from Double Indemnity. Elaine Johnson had been killed the same way that the playwright's wife had been killed in Death Trap. And was it possible that Stephen Clifton had been murdered by using the method in The Secret History? How had Charlie even known about Clifton? But of course, he might have. He knew about me and my wife. How hard would it have been to discover that Claire Mallory had gone to a middle school where a teacher had been accused of improper behavior with his students? It was unlikely, but not impossible. That left 3 books, 3 murders to go. The Red House Mystery, Malice Aforethought, and The Drowner. For all I knew, one or more of these had already happened, but somehow I doubted it. At about 11, I got out of the car, stretched, and went into the convenience store. It was one of those places that sells milk and basic groceries, but only exists because of lottery tickets and cigarettes. I bought a granola bar and a dusty bottle of water from the man behind the register and paid in cash. As I walked back toward my car, I saw a young woman in jeans and knee-high boots striding toward Pruitt's front door. She pressed the doorbell as I got back into the driver's seat. I swiped a hand across the inside of my windshield to watch the woman as she waited, rocking slightly on her heels. She rang the bell again, then tried knocking, then peered through one of the rectangular panes of glass that lined the side of the door. Finally, she gave up, looked at her phone, and turned around and walked back down the street. I got out of the car and began to follow her. I figured that if she was looking for Nick Pruitt, she'd eventually find him, and if I was following her, then I'd find him as well. She was walking fast, almost jogging at times, so I picked up my pace. At the end of Pruitt Street, she turned left onto Gloucester Road, climbing a short hill toward New Essex University, and eventually entering a 2-story brick building on the edge of the campus. A sign above the awning read Proctor Hall. I raced to the double glass doors and pushed through into a lobby-style entrance, catching the retreating figure of the woman, her boots rapping down a long hall to the left. A bearded man behind an information desk looked up at me, and I smiled and nodded like I'd seen him 100 times, then followed the woman down the fluorescent-lit hallway. She was pushing through the 3rd door at the left. A small placard told me she was in classroom 1C, and I peered through an inset window of wire-reinforced glass. All I could see was the curved back row of stadium-style seating, about 12 students sprawled at their desks. I pushed through the door and slipped inside, seating myself at the end of the back row. It was a large room that sloped down toward the front. It probably had room for about 100 students, and I guessed that 60% of the seats were taken. The woman I'd followed had removed her black parka and her wool hat and was now standing at the front of the room, looking nervous.
"Unfortunately," she said, "Professor Pruitt won't be able to make today's class. I'll be here for the remainder of the time in case anyone has any questions, but unless you hear otherwise, Friday morning's class is the same as scheduled, and the reading assignment hasn't changed.
Halfway through her announcement, all the students had begun to slide their laptops into their backpacks and put their coats back on. I got up as well and quickly left the room, walking back down the hallway, then outside, hoping my presence hadn't been too noteworthy to anyone. I wandered toward a bench with a view out toward the Atlantic, dark gray under a leaden sky. I sat for a moment, angling my body so that I could see the front of Proctor Hall, students now streaming out, moving quickly out of fear that their professor would suddenly show up and they wouldn't get the morning off. It was clear what had happened. Pruitt hadn't shown up to his class, hadn't responded to texts or calls to his cell phone. His teaching assistant had resorted to running down to his nearby house and seeing if he was home. I had a bad feeling, but tamped it down. Pruitt was a drunk of some kind. At least that was what Gillian Gwynn had reported. Maybe he was hungover. Maybe this sort of thing happened all the time, and his TA would sometimes be able to rouse him by banging on his door. I kept my eye on Proctor Hall, curious to see what the TA might do when she departed the building, wondering if she might go back down to Pruitt's house. Then I remembered her saying that she would stick around the classroom for the duration of the canceled class. I stood up, began to walk down the hill toward Pruitt Street. My body was telling me to get back in my car and drive home. Something had happened. A line of poetry went through my mind. Someone is dead, even the trees know it. And it took me a moment to remember that it was an Anne Sexton line, a poem about one of her parents dying, I thought. As I approached Pruitt's house, I studied the line of trees along Corning Street. They were all leafless, of course, and against the dark sky they were just black shapes, pencil scratches. It was hard to imagine them full of leaves on a summer day. Yes. Someone is dead. But it wasn't enough just to know it. When I got to Pruitt's house, I cut down his driveway, passing his car. I was wearing gloves, and I unlatched the wooden door that led to his fenced-in backyard. Drifts of crusted snow filled the square yard. There was a grill under a tarp, but nothing else. Unraked leaves, black now, were banked up against the far fence. I climbed three steps that got me to a small deck and a back door. Through the window pane, I could see a kitchen with a checkered linoleum floor. Beyond it was what looked like a dining room with a long table. The door was locked, and I knocked on the glass. I was about to punch through the window, but there was a row of old plant pots on the deck. Crouching, I lifted each one. Under a pot with rosemary in it was a single silver key. I pinched it between my gloved fingers. It fit the back door, and I was inside. I shouted, "Hello," into the empty house, then waited for an answer. I walked through the uncluttered kitchen into the dining room, going slow, allowing my eyes to adjust to the dim interior. All the curtains were pulled. From the dining room, I could see through into the front room of the house, to a long sofa. Pruitt was sitting there on one end of the sofa, his feet flat on the floor, his hands on either side of his thighs, and his head tilted back all the way, resting against the sofa cushion. He was dead. I knew that much just by looking at him, at how still he was, how exposed his neck was with his head at that uncomfortable angle. As shocked as I was by the sight of his body, I was equally shocked because it meant that Pruitt wasn't Charlie. I'd been so sure that he was, and clearly I'd been wrong. There was, I suppose, a minuscule possibility that maybe Pruitt really was Charlie, and the guilt of what he'd done had caused him to drink himself to death. But I knew in my gut that that wasn't the case. Pruitt had been killed by Charlie, who was many steps ahead of me. There was a very strong smell of whiskey coming from the room, and I saw the bottle on the floor, tipped on its side on the thin Persian rug. It caught what little light there was in the room, glinting from a line of wire that encased its triangular shape. I recognized the brand. It was a Scotch, but couldn't remember exactly what it was called. There was also another smell, one that made me think of hospitals. I moved in a little closer so that I was standing in the doorframe. And from there, I could see that there was dried vomit down the front of Pruitt's sweater. Knowing I wasn't going to go any farther into the room with Pruitt's body there, I glanced around. Not surprisingly, there were many bookshelves. In one corner was a large flat-screen television and what looked like an old stereo system. On the wall above the sofa was a large framed theater poster advertising a production of Shakespeare's The Winter's Tale. It included a line drawing of a bear with a crown on its head. I did notice that except for the bottle on the floor in front of the sofa, I'd seen no other signs of liquor in the house. I slowly backed away into the dining room and then the kitchen. I looked around there for liquor as well, but didn't see any. I opened his refrigerator. It was sparse inside, but there was a six-pack of beer on the top shelf, although looking at it closely, I realized that it was non-alcoholic. I shut the refrigerator door, wondering if it would be worth it to look around the house some more, or if it would be foolish to stay any longer. I knew what had happened here, of course, although I hadn't completely processed it yet. It was malice aforethought. In that book, a woman who is a drug addict is killed with a drug overdose, making it look like an accident. Pruitt was an obvious recovering alcoholic, but Charlie had somehow gotten him to drink again, gotten him to drink a fatal amount, or at least to make it look like he had. Chirping sounds like crickets suddenly filled the kitchen, and I jumped, my heart ratcheting up to full speed. It was Pruitt's phone, charging by the toaster on the kitchen counter. I went and looked at the screen. The person calling him was named Tamara Strahovski. I guessed that it was the TA checking in once more. How soon before she called the police, asking for a wellness check? I had no idea of knowing. I made a quick decision to briefly look through the house, a 5-minute search. The kitchen had two doors, and I went through the other one. It led to a back hallway, a half bathroom, and a room that was Pruitt's office. There was a standing desk, a laptop propped open on it, and more shelves, most of these filled with endless copies of his own book, Little Fish. I knew from visiting Brian Murray's home that authors got a number of their own editions, but not as many as there were in here. Little Fish filled two bookshelves, and there were stacks along the floor. It looked to be in the hundreds. I wondered if he'd bought copies of his own books, maybe to boost sales. From the office, I worked quickly down a side hall that led to the stairs. At the top of the landing, I peered into Pruitt's bedroom, messier than any of the rooms downstairs, and sparser as well. There was a pile of clothes on the floor, an unmade bed, and another hand-drawn theater poster framed on the wall. This time for Twelfth Night. I was able to get a better look at this poster. It was a production of the New Essex Community Playhouse, and the director was Nicholas Pruitt. Before leaving the bedroom, I glanced at the top of his bureau, cluttered with framed photographs, most of them old family shots, although I recognized a picture of Gillian Gwynne posing with Pruitt in front of what looked like the reconstruction of the Globe Theatre in London. I let myself out the back door and returned the key underneath the potted rosemary. Then I got back into my car and drove home to Boston. Chapter 22. I hadn't gone back on to Duckburg since 2010 when I'd arranged the murder swap, but I was thinking I needed to revisit the site now, just in case I could get in contact with Charlie. As far as I knew, I still had the site bookmarked on my work computer. It was early afternoon, and I walked from home to the Old Devils. Every time I blinked, I could see Nick Pruitt's lifeless body sitting placidly on his sofa, his head tipped back and his mouth hanging open. I pushed through the door. Emily was behind the register ringing up a sale, and I heard Brandon before I saw him. "The gang's all here," he said in his loud voice. He was crouched to my left, hunting one of the lower shelves, probably trying to find a book for an online order.
"Just for a while," I said. "Sorry, I've left you two alone so much lately."
"What's going on with you?" Brandon said, standing now, holding a copy of John le Carré's The Spy Who Came in from the Cold.
"Honestly," I said, "I haven't been feeling too well."
It was the first lie that popped into my head.
"Just extra tired and a little achy. Don't know what it is."
"Well, don't come here and spread it all around," Brandon said. "E and I've got it covered, don't we, E?"
She didn't respond, but I saw Emily look up from behind the desk. The customer she'd been helping, a semi-regular whose name I could never remember but who always bought the new Michael Connelly from us, was now shuffling toward the exit.
"I have some work to do in my office, then I'm going to head back home, I promise," I said,
and made my way there as Brandon started to tell Emily how his mother had had a cold for an entire year once. Nero was in my desk chair, curled into a circle, but he perked up when I came in, stretched his back, then leapt to the ground. I sat and turned on my computer. I was suddenly worried that I'd deleted the Duckburg bookmark, the smart thing to do, in all honesty. But once I'd gone online, there it was. I logged on, went to the section called Swaps, and did a quick perusal of the last 50 or so entries. It was the usual stuff, offers of work with the payment of either sexual favor or drugs. There were outliers, of course. A man looking to trade his wife's entire shoe collection, at least 8 Jimmy Choos, for a ticket to a sold-out Springsteen concert. I didn't see anything that referenced strangers on a train. I wasn't surprised. Charlie didn't need to get in touch with me because he already had, in a way. He knew exactly who I was. Still, it was worth a shot to send him a message on the off chance he was watching this site. I created a new fake identity, calling myself Farley Walker, and posted a message. "Dear Strangers on a Train fan, I'd like to propose another swap. You know who you are." I stared at the message for about 5 minutes after I'd posted it, wondering if a reply would come through instantly, but nothing did. I logged off Duckburg and did a quick search of New Essex University to see if anything had popped up in the news. I wasn't surprised to find nothing. Even if Nick Pruitt's body had already been discovered, and it probably hadn't yet, then it would hardly be newsworthy. It would look like an accidental overdose from an alcoholic who fell off the wagon. Unless Charlie had screwed up, it was a perfect murder. No one would suspect a homicide. I did wonder how he'd done it. My best guess was that he'd gone to Pruitt's door with a bottle of whiskey and a gun and forced him to drink. Maybe he'd drugged the whiskey as well. The bigger question I had was, how had Charlie targeted Pruitt in the first place? The only people who knew I was interested in him were Marty Kingship and Gillian Gwynne. Of course, Pruitt was related to Norman Chaney. And if Charlie had arranged for Chaney's death, then he'd have a connection with Pruitt as well. I suddenly remembered the book Little Fish and that I'd left it here at the store. Emily was now back at her own desk, dealing with online orders, probably, so I went to the register. Little Fish was there, where I'd left it. I realized how incriminating it was that I had a library copy of this book and decided that the least I could do was not leave it where it was.
"You had a visitor last night," Brandon said.
I looked up.
"Oh, yeah?
Brian Murray's wife. Is it Tess? I was here looking for you."
"Oh," I said. "Did she say what she wanted?"
"Nah, she said she was just dropping by because she hadn't been for a while, but I could tell she was a little disappointed you weren't here. She's not usually in Boston, is she? Not when it's freezing cold like this, right?"
"Brian broke his arm," I said. "I saw them 2 nights ago, and apparently she now has to be here to help him with everything."
"Oh man, that's hilarious," Brandon said,
although I wasn't sure it really was. I wasn't too surprised that Tess had stopped by the store. She had been in the book business, after all, as a publicist, and I was sure she was tired of babysitting her husband. Still, I couldn't help thinking about the way she'd hugged me goodbye after we had drinks at the Beacon Hill Hotel. "She buy anything?" I asked. "Nah, but she rearranged all the Brian Murrays for us." "I'm not surprised," I said. Before leaving, I copied the complicated link for the Duckburg site onto a piece of paper so I could check the site from my laptop at home. Then I grabbed Little Fish, told Brandon and Emily they might be on their own for a while, and headed home. Outside, tiny ice flakes of snow had begun to swirl in the air. Another storm, not a very big one, was threatening to arrive that night. I kept thinking of Tess Murray, how she'd come into the store. Had she seen my copy of Nick Pruitt's book? And if she had, so what? Still, it bugged me. I unlocked the outside door and climbed the stairs to my attic apartment. Inside, it was surprisingly cold, and I realized that I'd left the windows cracked, not something that I remembered doing at all. I shut them, then went immediately to my computer to check the Duckburg site. There was no response. I looked up Tess Murray. It occurred to me that I knew hardly anything about her besides the fact that she was the much younger wife of my business partner and that she'd been a publicist when they first met. I found who I thought was her on a LinkedIn page, although there was no photograph. It listed one of the big publishing houses as a place of former employment, plus a business called Snyman Publicity, and I remembered that Snyman was her name before she changed it to Murray. Her current place of employment was the Treasure Chest on Longboat Key in Florida, the small jewelry store she now ran. I wondered if she'd quit the book business because of her association with Brian Murray. It had been a minor scandal when they'd gotten married, mostly because she'd broken up his marriage, but also because she was so much younger and so much more attractive. The fact that they had been married for over 10 years hadn't changed anyone's opinion that she was a gold digger. I remembered a story I'd heard about her, probably from another local crime writer. This had been when Tess was still working as a publicist but had just started seeing Brian. She'd been at a cocktail party at Thriller Fest in New York City when someone made a disparaging remark about Brian, how he'd been mailing in his increasingly flimsy thrillers for years. It was not an untrue accusation, in my opinion, but apparently Tess slapped the person who had said it out loud, then stormed away. I remember that whoever had told me that story seemed to be telling it to show what a lunatic Tess was, but I'd heard it as a story that confirmed her essential love for Brian. I believed they had a good marriage. I checked my phone to see if I had Tess Murray's information on it. I did, both her email address and her cell number. I sent her a message. "Hey, Tess, Malcolm here, in case you don't recognize the number. Heard you were in the store and asked after me. Let's have dinner soon. The three of us. I'd love to catch up some more." I turned my phone screen off after sending the message, but as soon as I set it down, it buzzed, and there was a message from Tess. "Yes, come for dinner tomorrow night." I wrote back telling her I'd love to come and asked her what time and what could I bring. "7 and yourself," came the reply, so instantaneously that I wondered how she had time to even type the words. After the exclamation marks, she'd included a single red heart. I went to the refrigerator to get a beer. I had some eggs and cheese and decided to make an omelet for dinner, even though I hadn't felt any kind of hunger since seeing Pruitt's body in the morning. I put a bunch of Michael Nyman CDs in my old CD player and listened to his score for The End of the Affair first. I made the omelet and ate half of it, then opened another beer. I went to my bookshelf and found the section where I kept my Brian Murray books. I had almost all of them. Definitely all the recent ones, because Brian had his book launch parties at Old Devil's, and he always inscribed a book for me. But I also had most of the old paperbacks, the early Ellis Fitzgerald novels that I'd started reading when I was about 10 years old. I didn't have to get those particular books from Annie's book swap because my mom was an Ella Fitzgerald fan and bought all the books herself. The early ones were really good, like funnier Ross MacDonald novels. And it was a fairly big deal back then that the detective was a female, and a tough, uncompromising one at that. Brian had told me several times that in the first draft of the first Ellis Fitzgerald novel, The Poison Tree, Ellis had been a man. His agent told him that the book was good, but that it was a little familiar. He made Ellis a woman without changing anything else, and the book sold. I pulled out the paperback edition of The Sticking Place. It was the fifth Ellis Fitzgerald book and the one that won the Edgar Award. For fans, it was either their favorite book in the series or their least favorite book. For me, it was my favorite. At least it had been when I'd first read it as an adolescent. At the end of the previous book in the series, Temperate Blood, Ellis's on-again, off-again boyfriend, Peter Appleman, is killed by a member of the Boston Mafia. In The Sticking Place, Ellis gets her revenge, carefully and brutally murdering everyone who had been remotely involved in Appleman's death. The book has very little in common with the other books in the series. There are no buffoonish clients or Ellis witticisms. It has more in common with one of Richard Stark's Parker novels. I took The Sticking Place, along with a fresh bottle of beer, with me to my sofa. The book had been read so many times that some of the pages were slipping away from the cracked binding. The creased cover was black, with an image of a revolver, its cylinder cracked open to reveal six empty spaces where the bullets had been. I opened to the title page, not surprised to see my mother's name in her handwriting in the top right corner. Margaret Kershaw and the date she'd bought the book. It had been July of 1988. So I'd been 13 years old, and it was almost certain that I'd read this book as soon as I could get my grubby hands on it, probably immediately after she'd finished. I think I remember her telling me it was very violent. I'm sure that made me all the more eager to read it for myself. The book was dedicated to Brian Murray's first wife, Mary. I'd never known her, but Brian told me once that the reason he dedicated almost all his books to her was because she'd sulk for days if he didn't. He told me that divorcing her was good for many reasons, but mostly because he was now free to dedicate books to other people in his life. I began reading the book and was instantly hooked. It opens with Ellis meeting with the head of the Boston Mafia at the bar at the Ritz and handing him a list of names. "Either you'll punish them, or I will. It's up to you." He scoffs at her, tells her that she needs to forget it and move on. The rest of the book is her single-minded pursuit of those responsible for her boyfriend's death. It's suspenseful and violent, and Ellis comes across as slightly psychotic. After each killing, she applies lipstick and kisses the dead man on the cheek, leaving an imprint. The book ends with her at the Ritz again, drinking Chardonnay with the mafia head, who apologizes for underestimating her, and together they agree that balance has been restored. She's gotten her revenge. He does ask her about the lipstick. "I thought it would give the police a kick," she said. "Nothing they like more than some killer with a trademark. Makes them think they're in a Clint Eastwood movie." I finished the book at just past midnight. Kept thinking about trademarks. Ultimately, that was what Charlie's murders were about, leaving a mark of a kind, a signifier that told the world that the murderer was more important than the victim. Charlie might have been inspired by a sense of revenge or justice when he'd asked me to kill Norman Chaney. But now it was about him, and about my list, and about me, too, I guess. What kind of person puts himself above his victims? What kind of person becomes obsessed with a list of books? One of Brian's writer's tips he shares is that when you can't figure something out in the plot of your book, go to bed and let your subconscious pick at it. I decided to do that, to try and finally get some sleep and maybe even some answers. Chapter 23. I spent the next morning flipping through all my Brian Murray books. I even speed-read his latest novel, Die a Little, in which Ellis Fitzgerald solves a gang murder at a local high school. The novel was so dated that it was a little embarrassing. Brian hated research, and I got the feeling that all he did to prepare for writing his latest book was watch a double feature of Boys in the Hood and whatever that Michelle Pfeiffer movie was where she taught inner-city kids. At just past noon, I got a phone call from Agent Perez reminding me that I hadn't yet provided my whereabouts and movement for the times of the murders. "Sorry," I said to her. "I got busy. Can we do them right now? Give me the dates and I'll see if I know where I was when they occurred."
"That's fine," she said.
I opened up my calendar on my laptop and we started going over dates. First, she asked me about Elaine Johnson. "I sent that information to Agent Mulvey," I said. "I was in London when she died. September 13, right?"
"That's right,"
Agent Perez said. Then she asked me about Robin Callahan, who had been shot on August 16th of 2014. My calendar had nothing that week, except for the fact that I would have been at work that day. I told Agent Perez that, and she asked if anyone could vouch for me. August 16th had been a Friday, so I told her that both of my employees had probably worked that day, and that she was more than welcome to question them. Next, she asked me about Jay Bradshaw, the man who was beaten to death in his garage in Dennis on the Cape. It turned out that had happened on August 31st. "I flew to London on that Sunday," I said.
"What time?"
"The flight was at 6:20, so I probably left for the airport at 3.
"That's pretty early," she said.
"I know," I said. "I like to get there early if I can. I'd rather have extra time there than be running late." For the two other cases she asked me about, Bill Manso and Ethan Bird, I had no solid alibi, even though they were probably days when I was at Old Devil's. "Sorry, I can't help you more," I said.
"You've been helpful, Mr. Kershaw. I would like you to send me the exact flight numbers for your trip to London if you have them."
"Sure," I said, deciding not to remind her that I'd already sent those to Agent Mulvey.
"And just so we're being thorough, and I know this is a long time ago, but can you tell me where you were on August 27th of 2011?
"I'll look. What was it that happened on that date?" I said.
"That was the date that Stephen Clifton was killed in a bike accident near Saratoga Springs."
"You mentioned his name before. I don't know who he is. Agent Mulvey never said anything about him."
"His homicide was in her notes," Perez said.
I had flipped backward through my online calendars. I thought of making something up, but said instead, "I was probably working that day, but honestly, it was a long time ago. My calendar has nothing."
"That's fine, Mr. Kershaw. Not a problem, but I thought I'd ask."
"Okay, thanks," I said. I thought that would be the end of the phone call, but Agent Perez coughed, then said,
"I know I already asked you this, but when Agent Mulvey came to you, were you convinced right away that there was a connection between your list and the unsolved crimes? I'd like to hear your response again."
"I wasn't convinced, not right away, but maybe that had something to do with me not wanting to admit to a connection. It's a bad feeling, you know, having written some dumb list and then finding out that someone else is using it to commit actual murders."
"I'm sure it is."
She told me about the Bird murders first and how she connected them to the ABC murders.
"The Agatha Christie book?"
"Right. It seemed a stretch, honestly. But the man killed on the train tracks, Bill Manso, that murder did sound like it was emulating Double Indemnity, but like I said, I didn't really believe it until we found the books at Elaine Johnson's house. Then it was obvious. And it was obvious that the murderer wanted me to know about it, or wanted it to point to me, I guess. I don't really know. We talked a lot about it, the two of us."
"Who? You and Agent Mulvey?"
"Yes, we thought about what the person, what Charlie, that was the name we gave him, was trying to accomplish with the murders, and we thought that he really was trying to accurately convey the spirit of the original murders from the books.
Can I ask you about one of her notes? She had written down the three names of what she called the bird murders, and then she'd written who was the actual target. Do you know what that meant?
In the ABC murders, a series of murders are committed so it will look like a lunatic is on a crime spree. But the murderer had only one victim in mind that he really wanted dead. The other murders were cover.
So you think that might be the case with the bird murders?
I don't know if I think that, but it's a possibility.
Maybe it's a possibility that all these crimes, all the ones tied to your list, are just covering for one murder.
Sure, I said. It's a possibility, but if that were the case, that's a lot of murders to commit to conceal one.
Yes.
There was a lengthy pause, and I wondered for a moment if our call had been disconnected or if she was just thinking.
So if you had to guess, she finally said, which one of the three in the bird murders do you think was the intended victim?
If you forced me, I'd say Robin Callahan, because she's the best known of the three, and she pissed a lot of people off.
That's what I think, she said.
Then there was another pause.
Do you mind if I call you back with any other questions I might have?
Of course not, I said, and we said our goodbyes. I called Old Devils. Emily answered.
You still feel sick?
Not terrible, but not great.
Stay home. It's fine here.
I was about to end the call, but decided that while I had Emily on the line, I could ask her some questions. Can I ask you some names, and you can tell me if you've heard of them? I said.
Sure, she said.
Ethan Bird? She was quiet for a moment, then said,
haven't heard of him.
Jay Bradshaw?
No.
Robin Callahan?
Yeah, of course. She was that insane newscaster who got murdered. I'm sure she'll be the subject of an eventual true crime bestseller.
Why do you say she was insane?
I don't know. I guess I heard it.
She wrote the book about adultery, right?
Right,
I said. After ending the call, I thought some more about Robin Callahan being the intended victim of the three bird murders. And even if there hadn't been an obvious intended victim, there must have been someone that Charlie thought of first. He knew he wanted to emulate the ABC killings, and he knew he wasn't going to use the alphabet. If he decided that he wanted to kill Robin Callahan, then the way to cover it would be to find two more victims with names that suggested a bird. And Robin Callahan was a natural victim in the sense that she'd upset people. She advocated for adultery, and she'd wrecked at least two marriages. In the afternoon, I slept on the sofa. I dreamed I was being chased again, like I always did. Even when I was young, I would have these dreams in which I suddenly found out that my parents, my friends, my teachers were all monsters, and that I needed to run from them. In the worst dreams, I found myself powerless to move, my legs heavy, my feet stuck to the earth. That afternoon, in my dream, the only person I wasn't running from was Gwen Mulvey. She was at my side, and together we were trying to escape the murderous horde. When I woke up, I ran to the bathroom thinking I might be sick, but I wasn't. I dressed for dinner, tucking a blue checked shirt into a pair of dark corduroys, then putting on my favorite sweater, a cashmere roll neck in black, the last gift I'd received from Claire on the Christmas before she died. I stood in front of a floor-length mirror, and in my mind, I asked Claire how I looked.
You look fine, she said. You always look fine.
I imagined her running her fingers through my short, gray hair.
What should I do?
I asked her.
About these murders. It's your mess, she said. You need to fix it.
It was something she used to say, although when she said it, she'd always be referring to herself. It was what she said after confessing to me that she'd gotten involved with drugs again.
I told her I could help, and she said, "Ugh, no, it's my fucking mess, and I need to fix it myself." I used to think this trait of hers, the way she owned her failings, was a good thing, but now I'm not so sure. Her life was messy, but the most important thing for her was to avoid confrontation, to not upset people, to take on all the blame herself. Hurting herself was fine, but she would go out of her way to not hurt anyone else. It was her prime directive, the need to avoid collisions, to avoid letting other people take care of her. It's my fucking mess. But she was wrong. Chapter 24. I left the house without checking the weather and found that the snow